Well, it's 2:40, so I think we'll go ahead and start on time. How's that? Thank you guys for coming. I noticed yesterday that there was quite a bit of confusion in all of the conference publications as to exactly what this session was. I noticed at least four different titles for this session. No idea how that happened, but point taken for future conferences. So this is the Optimizing CIPs for Water Savings session. This session will engage you on all things CIP. We have an amazing panel up here. So we'll engage on CIPs and how you can utilize CIPs to achieve some of the water savings goals that you may have set within your brewery. My name is Cherie Chastain. I am with Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, but I am also the co-chair of the Sustainability Subcommittee. For those of you that don't know, the Brewers Association does have a technical committee, and within that technical committee are several subcommittees. The subcommittees include safety, quality, draft beer quality, sustainability, engineering, and IT. This panel, I'm actually really stoked about this panel. So I co-chair the Sustainability Subcommittee. Peter Kruger is also on the Sustainability Subcommittee. Denny Gorman with Boston Beer is on our engineering subcommittee, and Jason Perkins heads up our quality subcommittee. So if you have questions after this session about specifically the work that the subcommittees are doing, please don't be shy. Please come and find us. I know that there are other members in the audience that are part of those subcommittees. So if you see the technical committee badges, that's your people if you want to know what we're doing with your dues money. A couple logistical things before we get into this. Number one, if you have the app on your phone, please make sure that you are rating and providing feedback on the sessions that you attend, not just this session, but any of the sessions that you attend. I'm part of the seminar selection committee, and as a committee member, we do take that information seriously. We want to build the best conference for you and give you the information that you're looking for, so please provide feedback on the content, the speakers, and anything that you experience over the conference so that we can continue to build an even better conference experience for you. At the end of the session, we should have plenty of time for questions. Please come up to the microphones in the center of the room to ask your questions, jot them down as you go along, and we'll do all questions at the end of the session. So with that, again, our sustainability subcommittee, these are the current members of the subcommittee, so you can hunt down somebody from one of those breweries and ask them any questions that you may have about the work that we are doing. Again, this session specifically is part of the sustainability track as part of the conference. Now, part of the work that our sustainability subcommittee has done, and I know the rest of the committees as well, we work to develop tools for you. You are the Brewers Association, so we're trying to give you the tools and information that will help you be better, stronger, more efficient brewers. If you go to the Brewers Association webpage, hopefully you are very familiar with this webpage, but if you're not, this is the landing page for the BA website. In the best practices section of the website, you will find basically these are the focus areas of content development for the Brewers Association. Most of the subcommittee's content is all represented there. Because I'm on the sustainability one, I'm going to talk about that one, but there will be references to some of the other subcommittees' work as well as we move through the presentation. Specifically on the sustainability side, we have developed a suite of manuals to help you along your sustainability journey. They're pretty dense. They're pretty. There's a lot of material in these manuals. We're working on ways that we can distill that down into more easily digestible information for you. But these are the manuals that we currently have that take some deep dives into some of the more easily targeted areas of sustainability. We also have a benchmarking project underway that includes an online dashboard tool. There's a session on that tomorrow that I encourage you to attend if you're not already participating in that. So this session specifically, I'm talking about water savings, right? And hopefully you have at least some sort of awareness of where and how water is being used within your brewery. Hopefully you've set targets around water use. So this is the most recent drought map for the United States. The United States obviously experiences a very wide-ranging climatic variance within the country. But there's a lot of places in the country that are currently experiencing severe drought. Now, as the climate continues to change, we're going to see this swinging all over the place. We're going to see areas of the country that may not have previously experienced drought now finding themselves in drought conditions. And as brewers heavily relying on water, we all need to be prepared for that. And we need to be prepared for these climatic swings that we're going to continue to experience. This was back when the drought was really bad throughout the United States. This was July of 2012, and you can see that most of the United States was impacted by some sort of water scarcity or availability issue. So with that doom and gloom, I'm going to turn it over to our panel, and they will give you some amazing insights into how you can utilize CIPs within your brewery to address your water goals. We've got Peter Kruger from Bear Republic. He's going to kick things off with manual CIPs. Kind of do a poll here in the audience. Who here has a manual CIP protocol within your brewery? Quite a few, okay. We're then going to move on to Denny, who's with Boston Beer, who's going to talk about automated CIPs. Anybody in the audience have an automated CIP system? Quite a few, okay. And then we're going to wrap up with Jason Perkins, who is going to bring that all home with quality as the core. You know, you can make a whole lot of water savings initiatives within your brewery, but if you're doing it to sacrifice or at the expense of quality, you're not doing your brewery any favors. So we're going to bring it home with quality. A couple more just quick polls in the audience. How many of you in the room are working with or for or associated with a brewery that is less than 1,000 barrels of annual production? How many of you are between the 1,000 and 10,000 mark? Okay. 10,000 to 100,000? And then anybody over 100,000 barrels? Okay, great. We've got some good diversity in here. The diversity committee would like that. So I'm going to go ahead and kick things over. So Peter.
Thanks, Sheree. So I'm going to do a couple things today. I'm going to sort of give a testimonial about what Bear Republic went through in terms of water scarcity, touching on what Sheree mentioned with drought. And then I'm going to give some tips that we learned in terms of saving water during CIP, a couple key things. I do want to stress that, you know, saving water across your brewery is it's really arduous work, and it requires looking at all aspects of your brewery. But there are savings to be had in terms of financial and, you know, we are a forward-facing industry, so it's really important to, you know, do a good job presenting, you know, being stewards to the land. So, all right. So 2013, 14, 15 for Bear Republic Brewing Company was a really tough time. Cloverdale, the town where our production brewery is located, was one of 17 cities that was within 100 days of running out of water. This shows this is Lake Mendocino Reservoir as of about a month ago. And on the right is at the peak of the drought. So things were pretty grim. When the drought hit, the city of Cloverdale told us that basically that we don't have more water to give you, and we're going to put you on a water cap. So we had an 8 million gallon per year water cap. And 2015, we came within 40,000 gallons of that water cap. And if we didn't meet that, the city was going to shut our water off. So that was you know, that was right when growth was really ramping up. And so we were able to continue to grow by saving water, which was a good thing. So that's why we care about water, but why should you all care about water? So I call this, sustainability triangle. And really, it's the Lorax, the law, and the almighty dollar. So the Lorax is that, you know, doing things for the environment because it's the right thing to do. The almighty dollar, that makes sense. If you save a resource, you're going to save some money. And eventually, you know, what we got into was compliance issues with the city of Cloverdale, and that's what I call the law. So craft brewers, a lot of things. These are four of our brewers. You know, they're amazing people. They're fantastic to work with. But when we got into this water shortage and I did an audit about how people were doing CIPs, it was sort of the Wild West. Everybody had their own way of doing it, and on a 90-barrel tank, we went from anywhere from 400 up to 1,200 gallons of water to clean that tank. So, we pulled it together. Basically, what we did is we created recipes that were sort of as robust as our beer recipes, and got away from the choose-your-own-adventure, which really our brewers were doing. So our basic recipe is, first we drain our tank bottoms, we remove the carbon dioxide from the tank, we pulse rinse to both loosen soils and to raise the temperature of the vessel. We then batch a chemical solution. We verify the solution strength at 5 minutes into that recirculation. We circulate the batch for 30 minutes, set that on a timer. Running a 5-horse pump for extra time costs money, so it's not water, but it is an extra cost, and maintenance on the pump as well. And then we pulse rinse chemical from the vessel at the end. So we used to take our tank bottoms to the city, and in 2014, we got a call saying, hey, we have hops floating in the pond at the city, and we realized we were 65% of the design. We were discharging 65% of the design capabilities of the plant of Cloverdale. And so at that point, the first thing we immediately did was found a home for our tank bottoms. So we currently ship about 5,000 gallons of tanker a week to an organic, it goes out as organic cattle feed. And we went through the process of getting all the GMO, getting basically GMO certified on all of our ingredients so we could do that. So, and that goes to the folks on the right are Cheryl and Frank LaFranchi, who also take our grain, and they're local, so that keeps the trucking of that material down. So, this picture, some things get better with time. I'm not sure I'm one of them. This is me in 1997. And in 97 at Bear Republic, when we wanted to knock the CO2 out of a tank, we would turn a hose on and wait 30 minutes and, sniff and assume the CO2 was knocked out. So what we currently do is we open up the tank and we wait a couple hours and let that CO2 dissipate on its own. And that saved, a tremendous amount of water. So moving on to rinsing, when you rinse, you really want to incorporate pulse rinsing. It saves 25 to 50% of your water. You want to figure out how much water you're using for those rinses. So you want to use water meters. And then you want to create an optimized rinse schedule, just like in the brew house. So there are a couple problems with continuous rinsing that pulse rinsing solves. And basically, pulse rinsing is turning water on for 1 to 2 minutes to a tank, turning it off, letting it drain. And so the first problem with continuous rinsing is that you stack up water in the bottom of the tank. And this is it's a much bigger deal in dish bottom tanks than it is in cone tanks. But either way, you're building up solution. It's a very dilute solution, but it does have chemical in it, and that needs to get rinsed out. So continuous rinsing takes a ton of water. The second problem with continuous rinsing is your initial rinse, you create a very thin film, which is about half a millimeter thick on the tank. And as you continuously rinse, you are basically building up water on top of that, and that water is moving much slower down the tank than the stuff away from the surface of the tank. So again, you're sort of playing this dilution game with that rinsing. And this is a great article. I ripped this off for this seminar, but it's a really good article. I highly recommend this. And these gentlemen proved, and we've backed it up, that you save between 25 and 50% by pulse rinsing. So right after the water cap came in, as you can imagine, it put a lot of stress on me. I popped in the brewery one morning at 2 in the morning and found a hose on rinsing a tank and shut it off, and I waited 35 minutes for the brewer to come back. So that's at 30 gallons a minute. So he came back. He wasn't even in the building. He was at lunch. So, and I started thinking about, why did that happen? Well, for him, it was easier to let that water run than it was to, to stand there and time it. So we installed what I call the system to eliminate the dreaded bathroom break rinse, which is a three-part system, and it incorporates a push button with a timed relay in it that is set by, set by me or set by management, that basically that is the length of your pulse rinse. So that's on a two-minute timer, which delivers for us 44 gallons of water, 22 gallons a minute. And that's hooked up to a pneumatic valve that shuts water off at the end of that timer. And that's hooked up to a flow meter that the operator can use to keep an eye on it. But we've also, that's on a 4 to 20 output, so we pull that back to a plant historian. So I can then look at that on a trend and figure out when an operator cleaned a tank, take that information, print that sheet off. It shows a trend with the water being used. I can totalize that and go to an operator and say, and use that as a training tool. And it also allows, when we were setting this up, that allowed us to create best practices by looking at what different operators were doing. So when we put that system in, as I say, we were growing. 2011, we did 50,000 barrels. By 2013, we did 70,000 barrels. And our water use was going up, but it went up less than, our ratio was driven down, basically. So we knocked out about 0.3 gallons per gallon of beer produced by putting the system in. The other thing that's really important to do is to titrate. When we mix up a solution, we titrate to 2.5%. We'll run for 5 minutes. We'll retitrate, and at that point, we typically have to add a little bit of caustic. What we found is we run a little bit higher caustic rate. We dropped it down, but we run more than we got down to at the low point. But what we realized is having to clean tanks multiple times does really not save you any water. I mean, brewers don't like to waste the time, and it is a big use of water. So the other point I want to make is, as you get into water conservation, you really want to play nice with your vendor. You build a strong relationship with your chemical vendor. We work with a vendor who's in our plant every week. Once a quarter, they come in. They do outside audits of our CIP processes. I get a nice report, and it helps steer what we're doing. So, what we save at the end of all this, in terms of dollars, we saved $1.12 a barrel, which adds up. So, tank bottoms, that was a huge savings. We get paid for that. It basically offsets the drayage. We saved $58,000 in surcharges for that. We saved about $10,000 on water for cold rinse. Saved about $7,000 for hot rinse with water and energy included, and about $12,000 in caustic. So I wanted to end on this last slide because, water is a lot of things to the brewing industry, but to all of us, it's more than just an ingredient. This is a beautiful bluebird day I had on the Trinity River fishing about 3 years ago. And, half of the picture is water. And, water is really critical. It's critical to us as an ingredient. It's critical to our customers. And it's really important. So thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. So based on Cherie's poll, a lot of you have manual CIP systems, and you may be considering purchasing an automated CIP system. And some of you, an automated CIP system may be at the very bottom of your priority list. But as your brewery grows and your complexity grows, an automated CIP system is a great way to not only save water, but save utilities in general, save labor, time, all of those things. So before we get into the water savings, for those of you who don't know, that an automated CIP system is just like any other skidded process equipment, like a brew house. You've got an HMI, you've got a PLC, you've got your control panel, you've got your actual equipment, which is going to consist of tanks, pumps, external heat exchanger, automated valves, and the all-important instrumentation, which is really key to the automated CIP skid. And, of course, you've got your brewery equipment that you're going to clean. I won't go into like a whole lot of detail, but this is a general arrangement of an automated CIP skid. You'll see that we have multiple tanks, one for your acid, one for your base, and one for a water tank. And we'll talk about that water tank here in a minute. But before we go any further, why an automated CIP system? So for your brewery, you get repeatable, accurate, efficient CIPs, and you can guarantee those efficacies if you do a certain number of things to maintain the system and operate it correctly. So for your business, then you get less labor, you get utility savings, and all that goes into dollars. So, and then for your brain, sorry, I couldn't come up with a better B to go with the other two, but it's about sustainability and conservation and saving water, and the reason, you know, a lot of us are sitting here in this room. We're such an energy intense industry, so there's an onus on all of us to do our part to try and reduce those things that we use to make beer and to reduce our carbon footprint. So I broke it down into three main categories for optimization: design, commissioning, and then maintenance of your system. So kind of the life cycle of your automated CIP system. And there's a couple things that we can do within each three of these categories that are going to benefit you. And again, it's not only about water savings. It's about chemical savings. It's about electricity. It's about natural gas for steam generation. So it all starts with design. So if you're kind of new to it and you don't have an engineer on staff or you don't have an engineering consultant, you're certainly going to work with your vendor to design this system. So they're going to help guide you through the process for sure. But you have to provide the proper information up front for this to actually work. So, you know, the old adage of crap in equals crap out. If you don't give that good information up front, you're not going to end up with a properly designed system. And then you're going to end up wasting these utilities. So it starts with what? What are you going to clean? Fermenters, bright tanks, filler, racker, pipes, you know, the whole nine yards. That information needs to be provided to them. And you need to think into the future. What am I possibly going to do down the road as the business expands and the brewery expands? And then it's a matter of how are you going to clean? And this is where you're going to, you know, you'll probably call on some help to understand what's the best CIP recipe for your equipment, because it's going to be different for a racker, it's going to be different for a filler, and it's going to be different for a fermenter. So we're looking at flow, we're looking at pressure, we're looking at concentration, time, all of these things play into it. And then how much? How big does the system need to be? And this is another one that can really bite us if we don't take the time to look at these things. And we'll go into a little bit more detail about the volume question. So if you have CIP carts, maybe they're just a single tank, maybe they're a dual tank, but a lot of automated modern CIP systems are going to be a three-tank system. So as we said, you've got your two chemical solutions plus a water tank. So recovering the rinse water for later reuse, we'll talk about that in a moment, but you recover that cleaning solution. So you're not making up a fresh batch of cleaning solution every single time that you need to do it, or you're not making that cleaning solution up inside your fermenter and recirculating. You're able to bring that back, and you can continue to trim that up, adding more chemical to it as you go, until you make the determination that you need to dump the tank and start with a fresh tank because it will get fouled eventually. You also get reduced time. And this may not be a big deal in the beginning, but it may become an issue down the road. That solution's already there, made up for you. You're not sitting there waiting for it. Your CIP schedule can then just move on. We use a three-part system. We're doing a pre-rinse, then we're doing a caustic wash recirculation, then we're doing a rinse again, then we're doing the acid wash recirculation, another rinse, and then we're finishing off with a no-rinse sanitizer. So obviously a lot of water involved there. So anytime we can bring that CIP solution back into our system and recover it, it's a great thing and good savings that really add up, especially as you start to CIP more and more and more. So one of the great things about an automated system is the rinse recovery tank. And the way that we utilize this is after our caustic wash, we do a rinse before we start our acid. We'll bring that post-rinse after the caustic wash back into a recovery tank. That recovery tank then waits for the next CIP. And in the next CIP, we utilize that reclaimed water for our pre-rinse before we start our next CIP. So before we get into the caustic wash, we're knocking everything down and we're having that water. So that water doesn't go down the drain. We reclaim it back and use it again. I won't go through the calculation, but it's a fairly simple, you know, cost-benefit analysis when you're looking at the dollar side to it. You know, how much water are you using? What's the flow rate? How long are you doing it for? You know, if that's just fresh city water going in, all that stuff's going down the drain. And then it's a simple analysis of what does it cost to get that additional recovery tank and the associated valves and instrumentation associated with it versus what are you going to save on an annual basis in water and the conservation piece that we discussed. System sizing. So I've got just a little sketch here of you know, what a tank looks like and how we determine how much volume we need to make our CIP system. So I won't go through those details, but you know, the amount of volume that you're going to need to clean a filler versus a racker versus ferment, it's going to change. So you got to know those things up front. And again, this is where you got to try and have some foresight into the growth of your business and the growth of your brewery. If I'm going to add fermenters that are 50 feet away, well, that's 50 feet of pipe that's going to contain volume. So you need to try and think through those things if you can. Now, obviously, there's got to be you got to be reasonable about it to an extent. You know, if you got, you know, 50 barrel fermenters, you say, well, in 10 years, I'd like to have, you know, 500 barrel fermenters, and they're going to, you know, we're going to have this huge complex. Then it's getting a little unreasonable. But try and be considerate of what that could be. So where it goes wrong is if you have an undersized tank, and say you're in your caustic wash cycle, and your pump is starting to push caustic solution out to your spray ball and your fermenter, and you haven't got any of that solution returned back to your CIP skid yet, and your tank's about empty. So what has to happen is you've got to make up fresh CIP solution in the middle of your CIP cycle. So now you've got your circuit full, you've made up this additional solution, now you're trying to bring it back and recover it, but you don't have any tank volume left, so you've made up more volume in this circuit than what you can take back in this tank. All of that CIP solution that you made up midstream ends up going down the drain. So it's complicated to really think about all those factors, and your vendor will kind of help you out with that, but you want to try and have some foresight to where your brewery's going to go in that regard. So we as a panel wanted to put in at least one slide about, you know, safe practices safe design and best practices. And I don't want to talk too much about it, but every time you're putting in a piece of process equipment, any type of automated skid, you really got to think through the safety piece of it. So we just listed a few things out. Tank design, you got to have proper vacuum and pressure relief. Tanks need to be designed for the right pressure rating. You got to have weeples in your cladding, relief valves on your glycol to protect your jackets. Peter talked a little bit about tank venting. So carbon dioxide and sodium hydroxide create a vacuum when they're mixed. That could be a safety issue with your tank. They also will reduce the effectiveness of your caustic solution as they precipitate out into sodium bicarbonate. And then on your CIP system itself, you're going to have overflows on all these tanks. So you want to construct these so they're piped safely to the ground so they're not, you know, impacting your employees. And then the one that we struggle with a lot is our chemical piping. So you're going to have some sort of chemical drum that's automatically dosing these chemicals over to your system. We always specify we always get the tubing right, but for some reason the fittings always end up corroding pretty much within like a week, and we realize that we used the wrong fitting or something like that. Well, now you've got chemicals spraying around all over the place. So you got to really be diligent in those things and make sure that there's no issues there. And then I put a note about lockout, tagout. Obviously, give your guys who are working on it, you know, the capability to properly lock this out so they can do their jobs safely. So commissioning your system. This is a labor-intensive process. It takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of patience. But it's really like setting the framework for your CIP program moving forward. So you have to get these pieces right. Otherwise, all of your CIPs moving forward are going to be null and void. So things that you can do from a water savings perspective is you want to have a good CIP, but you want to determine what's the minimum amount of water that I need to do proper cleaning. So, you know, the whole adage of saying, well, I'll just rinse it for 10 more minutes. Well, that's not going to get you anywhere. You know, you need to go through the testing, and Jason's going to talk a little bit about this, and determine what is that minimum amount of water, because it's just repeatable over and over and over. No matter how many CIPs you do a week, that volume's just going to increase if it's not really needed. Interface detection. So on an automated CIP skid, you're going to use conductivity to determine these interfaces. As solution goes out and comes back, you know, you've got water to CIP solution interfaces, and your conductivity, if you use a conductivity sensor, it's going to detect that interface and determine if you return back to your CIP solution tank, if you turn back to a recovery tank, or you take it to drain. So you've got to get those dialed in correctly so you're not putting more water down the drain than you need to. And then trending and alarming. This is really one of the advantages of an automated CIP system. You've got a programmable logic controller. You've got an HMI that's going to give you the ability to look at your trends. So build these trends accordingly so you can go back and look and see, you know, where my CIP might have gone wrong. Perhaps from an alarming perspective, you say, I know when I clean this fermenter, when I commission it, it takes me 500 gallons of water to do it every time. Well, you've got a flow meter on there, and it's tracking that. So if you go and clean that fermenter, it takes you 700 gallons to clean it. You would want to see an alarm with that, so you can call attention to the brewer to come over and look at it and say, hey, what's going on here? Do we have a major leak? You know, is there an issue with a piece of instrumentation or something like that? So something to call attention to go after those pieces. So the last piece is then maintaining your system. And this is the part that people struggle with a lot. We struggle with it all the time. There's a lot of devices. There's a lot of instrumentation on this on your skid that needs to be taken care of. Calibrate your instruments. They are what's making your CIP system work. So you need to make sure that they are tuned in properly, that they're doing what you expect them to do. For instance, a flow meter. If it's instruments drift, if a flow meter is reading 10% below what it should be reading, it's going to put more water through the CIP skid. You're going to use more fresh water on your rinses, and you don't really need to. So you got to go back and routinely calibrate those instruments. Talk with your vendors that supply these instruments and say, what's a reasonable time for me to go back and do calibrations on these? Just general maintenance, leaks, you know, the whole thing. I got a leaky faucet in my bathtub. You know, if you just plug the bathtub and let that and see how long it takes to fill up that bathtub based on that drip, it's not that long. So those minor leaks do add up over time. Controlling user access. So as you get into automated, this is a big one, and we still struggle with this one all the time. How much access do you give different people that are operating your system? So, for instance, Brewer A is in the brewery at 10 o'clock at night, and he's got his last CIP, and it's an exceptionally dirty tank, and he just wants to get it done, and he adds 10 minutes to his pre-rinse. Well, that pre-rinse starts running for him, and it's good, and he gets done, and he goes home, but he never went back and changed it. So he had this access. He changed his set point. And never went back and changed it, and then Brewer B comes in the morning, starts up their next CIPs, and does it for the next week with double the amount of time on their pre-rinses than what you actually need. So you as brewery leadership have to determine who's going to have that kind of access, what can be changed, how long do those changes stay in place. And then finally, looking at your deviations. So we set up the trends, we set up the alarms. You know, you're going to have issues. Things are going to pop up. These are machines. They do fail. They do break. Ultimately, humans are controlling them, so when you have your deviations, look at them and determine why. So in closing, the best part about an automated CIP system is that it's automated. You get it's hands-off. You get less labor, you get these efficiency gains, but it's the worst part about it. It's also automated. We get complacent. We don't pay as much attention to it. We just kind of think, hey, we did our design, we did our commissioning, it's time to hit the button and walk away. You know, that's not always the case. You got to continue to maintain your system as you go. So we'll turn it over to Jason now, and he'll talk a little bit about the quality aspects of this.
All right. Hello, everybody. All right. So, yeah, you guys, this is a sustainability track. You guys are all here to learn ways to optimize your CIP process and save some water. And that's all fine and dandy, but in case you didn't get it, that's a but. Big elephant butt. So that's my job here today, is to be a little bit Debbie Downer here on this and just raise some awareness about, you know, anytime you're going to make a change, and this, you could say this for any process, whether you're optimizing for water savings or something else, you know, the impacts of your changes, you've got to make sure you validate them. So that's basically all, in a nutshell, what I'm here to talk about. And in the case of CIP water savings, this is just a theoretical example that I came up with to kind of drive this point home. So an eco-friendly brewer seeks to reduce water use in a brewhouse CIP. reduces the post-caustic water rinse of the wort line by 25%. You know, whether you do that manually or with some kind of change in the automation, could be the case in either one. Unbeknownst to him, another eco-brewer also reduced the rinse by 25% the previous week, and no validation was done in either case. Both people are, you know, with good intentions, but didn't double-check that their effect would what that effect would be on the process. And in the end, the first brew into a fermenter after a wort line CIP, 20 gallons of caustic solution is pushed into a barrel, and that tank is then dumped, 240 barrels of beer. And, you know, once again, you're at a sustainability track here, and nothing is less sustainable than that. So just a way to kind of drive home, it's a little bit of a silly example, but it's also fairly realistic that something like this could happen in a brewery. So one, take a step. I would just encourage everybody to kind of take a step back as you're getting ready to make any kind of a change, really, in this case, a change versus CIP. But really, any change, process change you're going to make at the brewery, now take the time to take a step back and really think about what's the goal here. What am I trying to achieve? Is it water savings? Is it something else? Time savings, chemical savings, whatever it might be. And what are we trying to achieve? Just take a moment to jot that down, discuss it with your staff. And then, of course, what are your current standards? You know, you should have some standards in place, whether that's time, caustic concentration, et cetera, in place. Hopefully that's very clearly spelled out. If it's not, stop there. Spell that out first before you move forward to the next step. And then, of course, how are you going to measure the effects of that change? And I'll talk a little bit about that. And tied to that is, you know, how will the new procedure be validated and change so the rest of the staff knows to move forward with whatever the new change is. First and foremost, I wanted to talk briefly about SOPs. It's not directly what we're talking about here today, but it certainly plays a big role in any process change in the brewery. Certainly very important before you're going to make a change to your procedure that you already have a procedure that's very clear and defined. So just a couple thoughts from me on effective standard operating procedures in a brewery. You know, one, they should be understood by all your staff members. And I would even extend that to say that staff members have full buy-in on it and, you know, understand the reasons behind it and have a venue in which they can raise their hand and ask questions about it. One simple way we do this at the brewery is we use just Google Docs for all of our SOPs. They're all stored, you know, in the cloud, and the commenting capability is enabled for every single brewer. So if they have an issue, they don't understand a piece of the SOP or they don't like a piece of the SOP, they have the ability to comment. Those comments go directly to whoever, you know, the leader of that particular area, the brewery, who can then address, follow up with that brewer. It's just a really simple way to get folks to have buy-in. We also, whenever we are writing an SOP, we seek input from others. If we can, we get brewers to write them. Nobody wants to write an SOP, so it's a little bit hard. But that's a good way to get buy-in as well, because if they're not behind it, they're not going to follow it in the first place. Thorough yet concise, and what I mean by that is, you know, you want to make sure you hit all the key points, but you don't want it to be a novel. You know, it's important to make sure you know what to keep in the SOP and what to keep out. There's certainly nuances that all brewers have, and sometimes you just have to let them have that nuance, but you got to identify what the key pieces are that have to be done the same way amongst everybody. For example, you don't necessarily have to have the direction that the elbow points on the outlet of a CIP pump into your SOP necessarily. Paired with standards, this is probably pretty obvious, but just making sure that your chemical concentration, the time and the temperature, all that stuff is very clearly defined and everyone understands it. And specific to each process, one size does not fit all. And what I mean by that is probably most of you in this room have multiple size fermenters, you know, and a procedure for a 30-barrel tank is not going to operate the same as a procedure for a 120-barrel tank or bigger. So just make sure that they're specific to the right size. And then probably the hardest one of all, updated whenever a change is made. You know, we all are in fastly operating breweries with change and growth, and it's sometimes hard when you make a change to not make sure that that's identified and the SOP has changed and everybody's aware of it. A couple other things that we do, just as examples, is this is a snapshot of a part of our SOP. We choose to use diagrams in addition to words just to help define process for folks. Good way to visualize things. So the majority of our SOPs for cleaning have something like this that, you know, demonstrates a flow diagram of what to do depending on what the tank is in. Another thing we do is employee acknowledgement, once again, just through Google Docs, basically. So this is the tail end of an SOP, the very end, at the last three steps. And then you can see in blue there is, you know, click here to acknowledge that you have read and understood and will follow the procedures outlined in this SOP. So anytime we make a change, this goes out again. So that way employees get that in their inbox and they have to sign in to here, read it through, and acknowledge that they have. It just sends them to this little SOP acknowledgement for CT2, and I understand the SOP and will consult my shift lead if and when the SOP can't or shouldn't be followed. So just, again, simple ways to get people be accountable, really, for making sure that they understand the SOP changes. And then to validation, and there's lots of different ways you can validate a change. I'll just go over kind of some general ways. When it comes to tank, especially, nothing beats visual inspection. You're going to see the obvious problems pretty quickly. And we still do this for every tank that we have, including our largest tanks are 540 barrels with hard pipes attached to the bottom with cone manways. It's not easy to take those things off there, a big standpipe underneath, but we still do it every single time. And you don't see a problem very often, but every now and again you do. And certainly if there's a process change you're making, I'd absolutely encourage you to do visual inspections for some level of frequency until you prove it out. Chemical concentration monitoring. Denny talked about this a little bit. There's a number of different ways you can do it. So if you're going to be looking to change your rinse steps, for example, on a tank, on a pipe fence, on a bottle filler, etc. You're going to want to make sure that you're still adequately rinsing that tank. The simplest, cheapest way to do it is just pH strips. I would strongly encourage you to go to at least the next step for titration. These kits are super cheap, and actually you get a hard number out of them, and they're very easy to use. So this is Nick, one of our guys, doing on our keg line, which we do on routine. But anytime you make a process change, it's good to make sure you're titrating that rinse water. And also doing some on some kind of regularity as well, so you have record of doing it, that you're validating on some kind of regular basis. Also, connectivity meters. So we have a number of connectivity meters at the brewery, and a couple are tied to automation systems, but the next two pictures I'm going to show are not. They're simply just ones we put in line with a readout. Relatively economical to do, and I can tell you this is in line here on our CIP tub for our centrifuge, which is also connected to a fair bit of piping. And we installed this really actually to kind of make sure that our chemical was getting mixed effectively and that we were rinsing effectively. But in the end, kind of after that, we realized we were intensely over-rinsing these pipings. So putting one of these things in line is a nice way to, in the end, save some water. We saved a pretty substantial amount of water in the CIP process by just having this, and the brewer can just look at that readout right on it. You don't necessarily have to tie it to an actual HMI and to an automation system. This is another one that's just same deal, just as in a line of pipe the brewer can just look at to confirm the chemical is mixed and also confirm that it's rinsed at the end. And then micro is important for a number of reasons. If you're going to change a process of a tank clean or a bottling line clean, you're going to want to confirm if you're going to reduce your chemical concentration or your rinse time or your heat kill step, whatever it may be. You're going to want to be able to confirm that. ATP testing is a great way to do it. It's a good thing to do on the regular as well. On a tank, I would encourage you to make sure you're checking a similar area or ideally the same area, maybe a racking arm port, underneath a manway, something like that, so you're always getting the same number. It's good to do this on a somewhat regular basis anyway to have record that your system is still working, but certainly if you make a change, great way to validate that you're still getting the cleaning that you need. And these are relatively economical. There's a number of different ones out there. And then in the lab, you can do membrane filtration of rinse water. pretty fairly simple. Any kind of limited lab skills, you can make sure to work that, make that work. Nice thing about membrane filtration is you can take a large sample, 50 mils, even 100 mils of rinse water, pour it through your membrane filtration, and then throw it on some media. And it's a good way to confirm that you've got, you know, you're getting the cleaning and sanitizing that you need. This is just a few more pictures of us taking the membrane and throwing on a couple different medias. Here we have LMDA, the green stuff, which is, you know, more of a generic broth. You could also use something like UBA, just kind of a wide spectrum of organisms and growth. And then we also have McConkie agar on the red one on the other side there, which is bacteria specific. But there's a number of different types you could use to get this kind of a confirmation. We use this, and we also, I don't have a slide on PCR, but PCR is another option as well. If you have that, whether it's one of the simpler versions or more complex versions, a good way to also confirm. We tend to use that, the microfiltration and PCR, when we're following a clean of the bottling line after we've, say, bottled Brettanomyces beers, since we'd use both wild beers and clean beers in the same bottling line. PCR is nice because you can get a very fairly quick turnaround on that data. But once again, if you're making a process change, a good way to validate you're still getting the sanitation that you need. And then, you know, I won't say much because Denny already touched on it, but calibrating tools is super important. You know, any piece of equipment you're using has the manufacturing standards for calibrating it. Make sure you do so. pH meters, obviously relatively easy, should be done on the regular. Connectivity meters, you can usually just zero them out in air, or you, I think some suppliers will provide you with a fairly expensive solution if you want to use that as well. Chemical allocators is something we found that can drift pretty easily. So we have a couple spots where we have not even fully automated systems, but allocators that are designed to kick out a certain amount of chemical, and those will drift, and we've found that those need some attention. And then ATP is more just making sure the unit stays clean so you're not getting false readings on there. Really, only other things I wanted to touch on are, and this is drifting slightly off topic, so but putting on my BA subcommittee hat. Unfortunately, this was yesterday, so you missed this talk already. Food Safety Modernization Act, but you can, it's very easy to get these presentations after the fact. I would strongly encourage you to listen to it. You know, with FSMA requirements, one of the big things of those is GMPs, which one of the big pieces of GMPs is SOPs. So I just thought it was a good opportunity for me to drive that home as an important thing to look at. Sri also mentioned the BA website with all the best practices. One of those that our subcommittee worked on was this template for food safety plan in a brewery. And you can see one of those is chemical inclusion template on there. And these are just templates for breweries to make sure that they're getting themselves on the right track with creating, you know, beer that's safe for a consumer to ingest. And chemical inclusion certainly has a lot of, it's connected to what we're talking about here today, because that would be kind of the easiest way for you to end up putting some chemical in a beer that you're looking to package as if, you know, something goes wrong in that CIP process. So, and that's all I have. I guess we probably have plenty of time for questions.
On the testing, the validating using PCR, are you using that with the rinse water?
Yeah, we've, like I said, we've really only done that on rinse water post bottling line CIP.
All right.
So we'll take and we'll actually run bottles through our filler after a CIP with deaerated water,
right? Okay.
Sterile deaerated water, and then we'll run that through membrane filtration afterwards.
Okay. All right, you're not doing it on fermenters or anything, though, just on the bottle.
We have not. I don't know if Mike's still here. Oh, he's not listening.
Yeah,
Mike might know. I don't think we've ever done that on rinse water. We have done it on plates, but not with PCR.
All right, cool. Awesome. I was at that Food Safety Modernization Act thing yesterday. If you didn't go, get the slides. I've been to like 3 or 4 of them, and that was the best one. It was really good. Everything is in the slides. Definitely get it.
Have you looked at using steam in the CIP process as a viable option, saving water?
We haven't. That would be a good thing to look at, but we haven't looked at that. So, no.
Okay. There were some vendors on the floor saying they had these steam producers, and I just haven't heard of anybody using them practically in breweries yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know that on fillers, you know, steam's used quite a bit on fillers for sanitation. But, you know, fermenters, I think you get into some safety issues with using live steam around fermenters and stuff. That would be my concern with that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we've never, we use it on our keg racking system, but we do not use steam on any of our fermenters. But we still run a CIP on our keg racker. We just do that as a sterilization step before we run beer.
Hi, question about the validation process for process changes and such. When you guys are implementing a new process or process change, especially when you need to do micro-validation, is typically one and done enough, or do you want to like run the process 3 times, 5 times before you consider it validated?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying to you if I told you we're super stringent with how we do it each time. But definitely our folks in the lab would encourage at least doing it in triplicate. So usually, yeah, and it depends on how drastic the change is, too, I think. If it's a pretty big change in process, then we would validate it multiple times. Once again, back to something like bottling a Brettanomyces beer and then bottling another beer afterwards, there's a lot. I don't even know. It's much more than triplicate that gets redone to make sure that that's safe. But for a fermenter, it's a little bit easier to not have to do it more than once.
Thanks.
Hi, Justin Smith, Tensleep Brewing Company. We're still very small, obviously, compared to most of you guys, and we're still slinging a lot of hose and doing very manual CIPs. I find I use a lot of water to preheat vessels, and it seems like a heck of a waste. Should I just be looking at chemicals that don't need the heat, or do you have any words of wisdom for the little guy that doesn't want to dump a lot of water?
Yeah, so one thing we noticed when we started to trend the temperatures of our tanks is when you, if you're burst rinsing with hot water, if you give it a couple minutes, that tank will continue to go up, and it'll take a lot less than you actually think. You know, that temperature is following your water, and it will continue to rise, you know, for a couple minutes after you turn that water off. So, and that was something that surprised us. We did a little bit of work with actually shutting the bottom of the tank, doing a burst rinse, letting that heat, you know, basically be absorbed by the vessel. But I just, in terms of getting brewers to do that, it was, you know, it's just, it added a lot of work to them. So, but try that burst rinsing, that helped for us. That knocked the water down by probably 50% on that heating the tanks.
Do you guys have any suggestions on any ways to remove CO2 in any quicker fashion than just allowing a tank to just drain?
We've done some work with a shop vac, and we had mixed results until the shop vac burned out. But, you know, the hooking to the bottom, you're going to get some yeast and stuff coming out with it. So I started working on a design to basically create a water trap that will absorb all that yeast and allow the CO2 to pass through that, kind of like a bubbler. I know that Lost Coast is doing that. There are a couple breweries in our area that are using a shop vac to speed that up.
We do a similar thing, but we force air through the top of our tank through the vent line, and we also use a trap system at the bottom for the residuals and stuff like that, and then pipe it away. And, I mean, a simple blower will work wonders pretty quickly.
Cool. Cool. Also, secondarily, I mean, we're working with 400 barrel tanks, and so like you're gonna have like some residual CO2 in there, of some concentration, and that helps to neutralize the caustic when you're running your cycle. I don't know if you had any tips on like anything to prevent that neutralization from happening. If there's any way around that, because we see the conductivity fall, and then, you know, we have to redose, and it's like kind of using a lot of caustic that I don't know if there's any way around doing
that.
Yeah,
I mean, I can speak to that. You need more time.
Yeah.
And if with a tank as big as 400 barrels, I think a blower of some kind is kind of necessary. We were pretty surprised when we admittedly weren't doing a great job titrating on some of our, when we installed some of our larger tanks, and we were pretty surprised. I mean, we had dropped it to 0% caustic when we were still blowing the tank with a blower for 40 minutes.
Wow.
So now we're blowing the tanks. Corey, what are we doing 540 barrel stat now? 90 minutes with a blower running. So it's pretty shocking how long it takes to get caustic out of those big tanks. And it depends on whether it's open in the bottom and all that. But, yeah, you need time to get that stuff out of there.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Thanks.
You actually asked most of my questions, so thank you. I guess related to it, if you're not using a blower, and it's going to depend on tank size, obviously, but how quickly are these tanks venting? And, you know, on a busy work day, is that realistic, I guess?
We scheduled it into our, Pat, we scheduled that into our day. I'm not going to say that every tank we have the luxury to do that, because there are times we have to turn tanks, and so we are doing exactly what Jason said, which is having to titrate up a significant amount of the CO2, but we have basically scheduled our week such that we have, you know, 2 to 4 hours to leave that tank open. So, you know, one thing I want to say with leaving it open is you don't want to leave it open overnight, because you'll crust on there, and then obviously, and then you have, you know, a big problem, and you're having to up your caustic, and that's a nightmare. So
thanks, gents.
I've been having discussions about how we treat our BBTs. Can you guys comment on your processes? Like, do you guys clean your BBTs every time you empty them, or are you emptying them, filling them right back up? And if you're doing that, what kind of testing are you doing in between to make sure they're staying sterile?
We clean our bright tanks either every third turn or once a week, depending on which comes first.
Right.
We're doing quick detect, after each turn to make sure it's still clean.
Like the PCR stuff?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but yeah, and, you know, again, for water savings, we don't filter our beer, so we did some work with using acid washing of tanks, but we just had too big a soil load. But that's my dream, to be able to not have to hit them with hot caustic every time.
So. Yeah, like, we filter our beer, so right. I've been debating with other guys about whether we need to be CIPing them every turn.
Yeah, talk to the guys at Avery. They've done a lot of work with that.
Avery? Oh, yeah. Okay. Anyone else?
We do acid CIP on every turn, and then we'll do a caustic CIP about every third or fourth turn.
Third or fourth turn, okay.
It'll be a full caustic acid cycle where we ventilate the tank, but we'll leave it under pressure when we do our acid CIPs.
Right, okay. Nice.
Yeah, when the majority of our beer is Allagash White, and we get a decent amount of sediment in the bottom of tanks, so unfortunately we clean them every time.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Any other questions out there? Okay, well, the panel is hanging around for the conference, and I'm sure that they would be more than happy to chat with you about any questions that you might have going farther. Thank you all for coming. Hopefully it was useful, and don't forget the survey. Thanks.